and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. The impact Chicago's low homicide clearance rates have on communities.
We are celebrating Pride out loud, and we are going to vogue until we can't anymore.
Chicago's ballroom scene is in vogue this Pride season.
By 1986, there were only about a dozen piping plover pairs left in the Great Lakes.
And you've likely heard a lot about Chicago's piping plovers, but why are they such a big deal? Patty Wetley has the next edition of WTTW News Explains. And now, some of today's top stories. Alder people are holding a hearing tomorrow over the Chicago Police Department's involvement in a recent ICE raid. At issue is whether police violated the city's welcoming city ordinance, which prevents local law enforcement from cooperating with federal immigration authorities when officers responded to a June 4th demonstration outside an ICE facility in the South Loop. Federal agents had detained undocumented immigrants after they were told to check in at the facility. Tensions escalated as immigrant advocates gathered to protest. ICE agents were seen pushing some demonstrators, including some city council members. CPD has said its officers were at the scene for public safety reasons and not cooperating with immigration enforcement. The city's Committee on Immigrant and Refugee Rights is holding that hearing tomorrow at 10 a.m. Chicago residents are getting the opportunity to share how they think the city can address its budget shortfall in a series of roundtables, the second of which begins in less than a half hour at Malcolm X College. The first was held over the weekend at Truman College. City officials have warned the city is facing one of the most difficult budget years in recent memory, with both a billion-dollar shortfall and the looming threat of federal cuts. The city says the discussions allow officials to hear directly from Chicagoans about which services and programming they think matter most and where money can be saved. That said, officials have yet to respond to WTTW News requests about how much it's spent in overtime for the first 3 months of 2025. For more on that and the next roundtables, please visit our website. As the U.S. Senate considers President Trump's so-called big, beautiful bill of tax breaks and spending cuts, local advocates are calling out how the legislation would impact Chicago-area safety net hospitals, among them Sinai Chicago, where 70% of patients are on Medicaid.
Medicaid is a lifeline. If the proposed cuts go through, it won't be just about numbers of people. It will mean fewer nurses, fewer doctors, more people suffering, longer wait times. And it's not just here at Sinai. This will be true for every single community hospital, and all the other hospitals will feel the effect as well.
Congressman Danny Davis made stops at five safety net hospitals that his office says serve 80% of African Americans on the west side of Chicago. Sinai Chicago says if the bill passes, critical programs would be cut, disrupting essential services and potentially closing some hospitals. The president has given Congress a 4th of July deadline to pass the 940-page bill. As more street closures take effect today for crews to set up for the third annual NASCAR race downtown, the future of the Chicago street race is unclear. The city and the motorsports organization inked a three-year deal back in 2022, but there's been no word yet on whether the race will return to Chicago again next year. Local businesses and residents initially hit the brakes on the idea because of the street closures required in such a heavily trafficked area. But organizers have downshifted the construction schedule to fewer days and made other adjustments based on input from fans. The festivities kick into high gear this Wednesday with the Family Fest and Dinner on the Track by Chicago Gourmet, then the races on Saturday and Sunday. Up next, we dig into the city's low homicide clearance rate and the disproportionate impact it's having on black and brown residents. And later in the program, we explain why Chicago's famed piping plovers are such a big deal.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Thank you.
For many people affected by gun violence, finding justice is an important step towards healing. According to the Chicago Police Department, 56% of homicide cases were cleared last year, but only 23% resulted in an arrest. Gun violence advocates say discrepancies in reporting and poor communication with victims is leaving survivors without badly needed answers. Joining us now are Yolanda Androzo, the executive director of One Aim Illinois, Rita Oseguera, an investigative reporter at The Trace, and Delphine Cherry, a gun violence prevention advocate. We should mention we also reached out to the Chicago Police Department to join us, but they declined our request today. I thank the three of you for joining us. Rita Oseguera, let's start with you. Please explain clearance rates. How are they calculated?
Yeah, so clearance rates are a tricky way of calculation. So the FBI has set a standard for how law enforcement should calculate these. And basically what they do is that they take the number of cases, of homicide cases, regardless of the year, over the number of incidents that happened that year. So it encompasses a lot of years beforehand. So that kind of makes it a bit tricky to see exactly what's happening year by year. And on top of that, there's also this category called exceptional clearances. And that includes, in the Chicago Police Department data that we saw, was bar to prosecute, which are cases that police had a suspect, but then when they brought it up to prosecutors, they denied them and rejected the cases, sent them back to police, either because there's a lack of evidence or procedural issues, whatever the case. And then that's a little gray area, what happens to those cases. And then the other category is death of the offender. So if the suspect is thought to be dead, then that also is clear. So some of these cases are cleared, but not solved.
Got it. So cleared, but that does not necessarily mean an arrest.
Yes.
But the arrests that happen as a result and prosecutions, those also get calculated into the clearance rates. But it seems like it's these other areas that make it a little bit gray.
Yes.
Okay. Yolanda, what is the impact of having low clearance rates?
Well, when there is no justice, you know, when survivors, those families don't have justice, it's continued re-traumatization. Right. So if you are if you're a loved one and your child, and sometimes not just one, but two children who have been lost to gun violence, there's no victim, there's nobody brought to justice, then you will find that there's even more crime that happens throughout the city. If nobody is held accountable, then you're going to continue to see more shootings.
Yeah. If nobody is held accountable, then that means people who might consider committing a crime, like, you know, why not? What's the risk?
Yes.
I'm not going to get caught.
Yeah.
Delphine, you've lost two children to gun violence, and my condolences. I'm sorry to hear that is the case. One was solved and the other was not. Why do you think that was?
A lack of, how can I say? They dropped the ball on my son's case. There was no evidence. Well, they said it was evidence, but the evidence was tainted. They did not search for a suspect. So his case has been unsolved for 12 years now. And I feel like it was a lack of responsibility of the police department. I live in the suburbs, I don't live in Chicago. That municipalities, to me, don't take it seriously that you lose a loved one.
What was the instance? Tell us a little bit about those two cases, if you would. Your daughter died in 92, and her case, it got media attention because of how and where it happened.
Right. So my daughter was on the Gold Coast, a couple of blocks from Oprah Winfrey's house, and she had went to see the premiere of Juice movie. And back then, if you notice, there was a lot of people getting shot back then. And as her and her friends were coming out the theater, a young man and his friends got into a fight. He got a gun, tried to shoot a rival gang member. The bullet hit a building, ricocheted, and hit her in the head, killing her instantly. So she was not the intended target. 20 years later, I'm pregnant with my son, and he goes to work, come home, get ready for a friend's party that he do every year. He never made it out my driveway. You know, he was shot. Ambulance never came. His friend took him to the hospital. He sat there and literally bled to death with no help. So I felt like my community felt me as a parent, felt my son as the victim. And as far as the clearance rate of homicides and where I live at, they don't get solved that often or at all.
And your son's death happened in Hazelcrest.
It happened in Hazelcrest, in front of my home, as he was getting ready to go to a classmate's birthday party, like he do every year. And he never made it out the driveway. No witnesses, so they say, but he was alive when his friend took him to the hospital. And he was talking. And he waited in the emergency for 23 minutes before he got waited on.
Before he was treated.
Yes.
So, Rita, though gun violence happens everywhere, your reporting found, and, you know, in the case of you, Delphine, once it happened to your daughter in Gold Coast, and then it happened to your son in Hazelcrest. Your reporting, Rita, still found that there is a disparity in the amount of crimes solved depending on certain factors. What are those factors, and why the disparity?
Yes, so in our data, we found that in Chicago, homicides were cleared by arrest within a year. For black victims, it was 21%, and for white victims, 38%. So there is a large gap between those two. And the reasons behind it depends really on who you ask. If you ask about police officers, they'll say that it's a lack of resources in order to clear cases and a lack of witnesses coming forward. And especially among the black community, there's a lack of witnesses, they say. And then if you talk to survivors, they'll explain that a lot of people don't feel comfortable coming forward because they don't feel there's a system or structure in place within the police department to keep them safe. And then they also don't think, even if they do come forward, that information will be used. And if they think, oh, the case aren't going to get solved, then why should I risk myself? So there are some of the factors that come into play into why there's a disparity between them.
Right. In Delphine's case with your daughter, you know, there was media coverage. Her killer was found and sentenced to 50 years in prison. I believe he served 20 and was released several years ago.
Actually, he was released the same year my son was murdered. So he did 20 years of a 50-year sentence. He was 14 when it happened, and he was 34 when he got out. So I figure he got his whole life ahead of him.
I raised that question just because there's also a conversation to be had about the role of the media, Yolanda, in how the media covers these cases. What would you say that role is? And how has it been done? How could it be better or different?
Yes, the survivors that we work with in our Survivors Council have shared that, you know, especially for black and brown communities, that the media does not cover it as they do in, say, something like a high-profile case, like, let's say, the Highland Park mass shooting, right? And so we work really hard to ensure that those survivors that we work with, that they're heard, that their cases are heard. And that's why, you know, coming on to shows like this are really, really important.
Well, what can be done to repair the relationship between black and brown communities that are not seeing a higher clearance rate in their communities?
Well, one of the things, right, we recently passed the Homicide Data Transparency Act, right? And so that will ensure that police departments regularly publish homicide data and share that with the public and share that with communities that are most impacted. So that is one step towards, you know, kind of healing that relationship. Another step towards it will be passing something that we're working on, our coalition is working on, called the Homicide Victims Families Rights Act. And this would ensure that after a case is cold, after 3 years, that surviving family could apply for that case to be reviewed. And if it's accepted, a new detective, fresh eyes, would be put on that case. And it also would assign family liaisons trained in trauma-informed care onto that case to ensure that, you know, families are treated with respect and humanely. Because often, as something that Delphine shared, in the case of black boys being shot and killed, black girls being shot and killed, black and brown youth individuals being shot and killed, it's often looked at immediately as this is gang-related, right, without any investigation. So it feels as if, you know, we don't matter. And the case doesn't matter, the victim doesn't matter, the survivor doesn't matter. So when we pass this, and we're really hoping to pass it, didn't pass last session, but we're hoping to pass it this upcoming session, that will also do some healing work between police departments and communities that are impacted.
Delphine, you've done a lot of work on your own to solve your son's case. What has that looked like?
it's hard. It's hard. So whenever I get some new information or something that I could use, I'll call the police station and say, hey, I got some new information. And they'll say, text it to me. I'm like, text it to you. I can't text it on a public phone. So with my son's case, the detective that was on his case, what I did was I sent him a card with my son's picture and a picture of his family and said, look, I know you have children. This was my son. It could have been your son. And he's like, Miss Cherry, I was told not to continue to work on your son's case. But I would do it. I just can't let them know I'm doing it. And he's retired now, and still today, I contact him when I have new information.
In hopes that he can help you kind of think through
right. I mean,
what to do with this information.
It's funny because when he retired, he did come to me and say, this was my suspect, but I need a witness to come forward and say that they saw him. And I can't say it publicly, but there were several witnesses that saw this person that won't come forward.
So, and the case obviously remains open. Rita, before we run out of time, what are some recommendations for the CPD or for any police department to improve clearance rates?
Yeah, so CPD has acknowledged the problem in low clearance rates, and they actually commissioned the Police Executive Research Forum to provide some recommendations, and they recently released a report with those recommendations. And some of the things they've done is they've added the family liaison officers to improve that communication with the families and the detectives. There's new area technology centers that are better equipped to handle all the videos and process that the technology that is needed to solve cases. And there's more added forensic staff, things like that. So there's more resources specifically for detectives.
Okay, that's helpful. We're out of time, but my thanks to all three of you for joining. Delphine Cherry, thank you for sharing your story.
You.
Rita Oseguera and Yolanda Androzo, thanks to you both.
Thank you for having
us.
Thank you.
Up next, inside a creative Chicago community that's always on the move. Strike the pose, come on, Vogue. Chicago's ballroom scene is front and center this Pride Month. And no, not ballroom like the classical dance style. Ballroom as in the subculture that was pioneered by queer and trans individuals. It includes key elements like houses, balls, and most famously, voguing. A local who's in the scene explains more.
Voguing is a freestyle dance form that was born in this underground black and brown queer nightlife space.
Ian DeMont Martin is in the Kiki House of Juicy Couture. The house is like a chosen family. He's been going for Vogue classes for the last 2 years.
We all sort of are brought or are drawn to this community for a reason, and I think it's the opportunity to be a part of something, to really tap into a legacy.
Ballroom culture originated in 1960s Harlem alongside voguing. As the name suggests, the style is inspired by famous images of models in Vogue magazine. But traces of the culture date back to the 19th century, with William Dorsey Swan, a Maryland man born into slavery who later went on to lead a gay resistance group and hold drag balls.
I'm a larger black man, and so like, what does it mean for me to put on like this block heel and step into like this really feminine dance form? Like, that is resistance, that is revolutionary.
Across town from Ian's apartment is Task Force, a grassroots organization in the Austin neighborhood that supports the health and wellness of LGBTQ plus young people. And they recently had a ball.
I am the overall princess of Alpha Omega.
As in the house of Alpha Omega that was featured on the reality TV show Legendary.
Houses is families. It's just chosen family. They want to see you do greatness. They wanted it, but they also want to protect you from the world as well, too. So
West Side native Skye Underwood is the first performer out of the Midwest to win a latex ball, a major ball in New York City.
I used to really battle with my identity, but then when I came here and I just started to see, like, oh my God, it's so many people that look like me, act like me, and hell, my God, it's like I want this for myself. I'm like, I want to be able to be as free as them.
It's an affirming space. We affirm their identity and we celebrate, you know, their culture and the things that are important to them.
Chris and the rest of the task force team partnered with the Pride Parade this year, a first for a community-based organization.
We are celebrating Pride out loud, and we are going to vogue until we can't anymore. And, you know, while I am not a voguer, I will try. I just won't do the, you know, the things that are heavy on your knees.
I've been going to Prides for a long time. I've been weary of the corporatization, the weary of the commercial aspects. We thrived and survived without corporate interests, without support from the government, and we can thrive and survive now.
Historically, Pride has been a protest, and it seems that those roots of resistance may be re-emerging. According to the ACLU, there are 597 anti-LGBTQ bills in U.S. state legislatures right now. Illinois has 15 of those bills.
And so this Pride, I'm going to some balls. I'm going to vogue my life away, because there was a time where we couldn't do that, where we couldn't gather, or we didn't feel safe to. And we don't know where the rest of this stuff is going socially, culturally. And so for me, I got to make sure that I'm doing that I'm doing it loudly, I'm doing it proudly, and that, yeah, I'm having fun doing it.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Shelby Hawkins.
Up next, an avian love story for the ages. But first, a look at the weather. Every summer for the past 6 years, Chicagoans have gone plover crazy. I'm talking about piping plovers, the endangered birds that have decided to raise their family on the lakefront. Three new plover chicks hatched about 10 days ago at Montrose Beach. So what's all the fuss about? We explain, well, we thought it was time to explain. Here's Patty Whitley.
Chicago's lakefront is famously open and free. So why is a prime section of Montrose Beach roped off every summer? Because it's for the birds, literally, the piping plovers. Piping plovers are tiny shorebirds about the size of a smartphone, but a fraction of the weight. There used to be a few thousand of them spread across the entire Great Lakes, but then people took away a lot of the beaches where they lived, building houses, hotels, marinas, and resorts. By 1986, there were only about a dozen piping plover pairs left in the Great Lakes, all of them nesting in Michigan. The future looked so bleak for our feathered friends, they were officially added to the endangered species list. Fast forward to 2019. Two of these rare creatures, a male and a female, turned up on Montrose Beach. Chicago's birders rejoiced.
Huzzah!
There hadn't been a nesting pair in Cook County since Harry Truman was president. But against all odds and logic, a pair of plovers had landed on one of the most crowded beaches in Chicago and decided to start a family. Amazing! Maybe a slightly unwise choice on the plovers' part, but amazing. An army of volunteers quickly formed to protect the plovers, who they named Monty and Rose, from beachgoers and other threats. Long story short, the couple, and eventually their chicks, spent the summer charming the pants off Chicagoans before flying south for the winter. And what do you know, like all summer blockbusters, this tale has a sequel. Monty and Rose returned to Montrose to nest again in 2020. Incredibly, they landed in Chicago within hours of each other, despite spending the winter on opposite sides of the Gulf of whatever. The dynamic duo completed the trilogy in 2021, raising a third group of chicks at Montrose. Alas, in 2022, the saga took a tragic turn. Rose never made it back to Chicago, and Monty died of an infection, though some would say it was really of a broken heart. Still, the legacy of these lovebirds lives on, not just in their son Imani, who's also found a mate at Montrose, but in the goodwill these two crazy kids created for their species. Monty and Rose, putting the love in Plover.
And if you want a chance to name Chicago's newest three Pipe and Plover chicks, there's a contest in the works. We've got details on our website. And that's our show for this Monday night. You can stream Chicago Tonight on our WTTW YouTube channel every evening and catch up on any programs you may have missed. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Wrapping up a busy term at the U.S. Supreme Court, we look at the impact of some of the major decisions. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.